This episode of See Here has been sanitized for your protection.
This is called See Here. Of course, what the world needs now is not Love, Sweet Love. What the world needs now is a new podcast. Specifically, this is a podcast about movies that are related to music. We'll explain a little bit further as we go on. But my name is Morris, and with me on the other end of a Skype connection is Tim Merrill. Good evening, Tim.
Hey, how you doing?
And Wendy Freeman.
Hey there.
Hey, so this show should start off with an Australian, a Canadian, and an American walk into a bar or something like that. I love the magic of Skype and podcasting because, really, it allows all us people from opposite sides of the planet to be conversing in such lovely and understanding sort of ways, and maybe to argue and all that sort of thing. But anyway, so, yes, the idea behind this podcast, well, Tim, Wendy, one of you, explain how we came to be in this position.
Well, we had that episode of Silver and Gold, our dear friends over there at Silver and Gold, where we were talking about the Beatles and music movies, and we just had a blast.
We did. We decided to make it a regular thing. Not regular as in getting bowel movement, although we will be talking a little bit about that later on in this episode. But
more than a little.
Yeah, as in once a month, we decided we'd like to, you know, get our views out there. There's a lot of great film podcasts out there, but there doesn't seem to be anyone who's doing a regular podcast about music-related movies. And we thought, well, you know, there was quite a hefty amount of them out there. So the whole purpose behind this is, you know, once a month, we'll pick a film that's got some sort of music-related theme to it, and it can be a documentary, it can be a narrative.
Something I want to get off my chest here for a minute. I think that a lot of people, when they talk about music movies, a lot of people, I seem to think that people feel it's such a narrow subgenre where people say, oh, music movies, you mean like The Sound of Music or Pink Floyd's The Wall? Mm-hmm. And it's either one or the other. But what people don't realize is that, you know, it's like history, because of the sense that everyone, when you talk about to people about history, they just think that you're talking about, you know, dead people who died in the war, dead presidents, right? But there's so much to history. I mean, you got the history of film, you got the history of music, history of art, history of clothing, history of history, right?
Right.
So I think with music movies, it's so deep. For example, you can look at The Harder They Come, Jimmy Cliff. You know, you can look at, as we did, you know, we looked at, you know, Help. I mean, there's so many variations that you can get into. I mean, everything from, like, Sun Ra, Space is the Place, to... Go ahead, Wendy, I'm sorry.
I mean, I was thinking, like, even, like, Streets of Fire, Six String Samurai, things that, you know, there's plenty of action films that involve people in bands or you know, music undercurrent.
Right. But I was thinking about a lot of this when Eric and I covered Human Highway, the GGTMC.
Right.
And, you know, that's another classic cult film. But I think that, you know, like you're saying, Morris, you know, like, to define the music movie, it's not just by cult status or popularity. I mean, you have the documentaries, you have the pseudo documentaries, like, or the pseudo biographies, you know, for example, like Ray. You know, or other things like that, you know. And then you've got, you know, like the classics, like The Last Waltz, or, you know, you've got all cut, or The Song Remains the Same. I mean, you know, it's endless, really, when you look at it.
There's quite a lot of it out there. I mean, I guess what's up for discussion is the fact how, I don't know, I mean, I guess how it is over in North America, but certainly over in Australia, I know that for a long while, the idea of a music-related film, well, maybe more like a concert-related film, I guess, has been cinematic poison. In your experience in recent years, how, like, Wendy in America, if there's something about a band or a concert-related film, can it be successful? I mean, apart from, say, Glee the concert.
No, it seems like, yeah, like, every year now there's, like, a Katy Perry 3D or a Justin Bieber 3D or, so, you know, like, that's what we get as far as, you know, I feel like that's the current concert film thing. Or, like, there was that LCD sound system. There was, like, that but concert film with that final
even
show.
More than that, it just seems now that, you know,
you really can't say you're anybody anymore until someone's made a documentary about you. Because, I mean, you know, You look now like at stuff like, for example, like Sugar Man, Death, Rocky Erickson's had a documentary made about him, and
yeah, the big star movie.
I mean, right, everybody.
I went to go see one about Kathleen Hanna.
Oh, the Bikini Kill one, yeah, right.
Yeah.
She was a girl for the Riot Girl movement, you know,
yeah,
in the United States.
I can't fucking stand her, and I got dragged to that movie.
But that's the beauty of a podcast like this. We can really speak about anyone or anything, regardless of whether musically they excite us. You know, history, you know, Tim, you're a historian. We've been talking about how much history has to tell us. And within the music documentary world, really a story can be just as fascinating. Or maybe, you know, a whole lot more fascinating than the actual art that's being created. Really, I think the sky.
Exactly. That's the thing, like, Wendy, you know, like you're saying, you couldn't stand Kathleen Hanna, but you probably enjoyed the documentary, right?
I gritted my teeth, and I made a list of 10 more relevant punk rock women that I've never had to
hear about. Sure. But I mean, you know, but I think those are the great documentaries, is that even when you have no interest in the artists themselves, you walk away with a greater respect, or at least becoming illuminated about something that you never realized before, you know?
Yeah, it's true. And I have chosen to see a lot of documentaries about people I barely knew anything about and became very interested from that, yeah.
Did you follow up much on their music?
Oh, yeah, I mean, in certain cases, you know, but yeah, in this case, no. I hated her going in, and I was going with, like, some other girlfriends who were in bands. I was the only one who disliked it.
So what was it about the film that you didn't like? Was it just like a puff piece?
It was very, very much like you could tell she definitely was in control of how she was, covered. It was definitely, if we ever do an episode on that, we could do it, but I'm not going to go into my dislike of that. The whole other episode.
I remember, a few years ago watching the Wilco documentary, I'm trying to break his heart. And I think, like, the aim had originally been that they were going to just make one of those, you know, bonus DVDs that come out with a new CD. But when, I can't remember the name of the director, but when he went in and saw the dynamic and especially the tension that was going on between Jeff Tweedy and Jay Bennett, he realized, oh no, this is no supplementary DVD. This is a bona fide movie that we have going on here.
And then to have the Yankee Hotel Foxtrot controversy happen in the middle of that.
And then to end up with the same label. More or less at the end of it. It was an absolutely fascinating story. But I guess, yeah, that is an interesting thing, how you distinguish between those, really, those DVDs that come with CDs, which are no more than glorified electronic press kits, and the real documentaries, I guess, that have something to say. But, you know, both would be great to talk about over the life of the program, for sure.
Well, another interesting one was the Lee Von Helm one that came out last year.
Right.
And how, like, not in it for my health. And how, like, it had started to be this story about, you know, like, his midnight rambles he'd been putting on, his battle with cancer and stuff, and then it turned into, like, the reunion, like, how they refused to reunite at the Grammys, you know?
Right.
I'm really looking forward to seeing that. I still haven't seen it. Was your interest because of, you know, your love for Lee Von and the band? Or was it actually a well-made film? I mean, was it...
It was a well-made film. Like, he's just a phenomenal personality, and I think that's the big key to good documentaries, is your subject has to be a really engaging personality.
Right. I mean, so, like, coming out of, you know, recently watching Nothing Can Hurt Me about Big Star, in the end, I sort of thought I was grateful to have something on film about yes. you know, this band, which I absolutely love and adore, but I mm-hmm. thought it was a bit slapdash. Oh, we'll have a little bit of this, a little bit of that. I remember our good friend and compadre, Mr. Eric Peterson, had gone and sent me a couple of years ago one of the 33 and a third series of books about the making of Radio City. And it was only because I'd read that that I could fill in the gaps. But if I was coming in clean, having heard the records, but knowing nothing about their history, I would have come away very confused about their history just from watching the film. It was only because I'd read the book that I felt also, a lot more comfortable.
There's a thing that really stands for me with documentaries is that this idea that, you know, the directors get into a position where you're either... It's either one of two stances where you're either making it strictly for the fans or you're making it for a wider spectrum of people. And, you know, for people that, you know, you kind of clue people into who the band was and you kind of lay down the groundwork of the history in the film. But from the first perspective, it's like, if you know the band, you don't have to go through any of that shit. And it just gets into the gets deep into the band or the psyche of the members or whatever is there, you know. But, I think the more popular to me, the more successful music documentaries are the ones that kind of go for a wider spectrum because it's like they lay down the history and they tell you why this band is so vital and where they came from and how they started and where they are now, like how they got from A to Z. And everything they went through.
Right.
I think that's a far more compelling method of film instead of, you know, just saying, well, here they are in their element. You know who they are. We're not going to tell you. So let's just be a fly on the wall and watch it unfold, you know?
Although a good example of that is Some Kind of Monster, that Metallica movie, because that captures them at their most, like, ridiculous, you know?
You mean the,
exactly?
You mean the?
I make $5 million a year. I'm not happy.
Yeah, it captures them. It's not about like who they were. It's about them in this like horrible, ridiculous moment that they're in at that time. You know.
Right. In fact, actually, right. Probably the films that tend to work for me, I guess, in the I guess this is more in the narrative sort of vein. Is a film that captures a period like Some Kind of Monster did. One of my favorite narrative types of film is Backbeat about the Beatles in Hamburg. Yes. Now, I mean, okay, obviously you could say, you know, the Beatles in terms of documentaries have been done to death, but I like the fact that they took just that aspect. We're not going to try and give it a full 8, 9, 10 year history in 1, 2 or 3 hour film because that's just ridiculous. Like they did with, say, Ray or Walk the Line. So we're just going to take this one brief part of their history and then you know the rest. But this is what made them what they were, regardless of whether it, you know, how factual or not it was. But it was an entertaining, really well woven story. I know that there were some complaints saying, yeah, Paul was made to look like, you know, the handsome, greedy one and Pete Best was just the dumb drummer who said, well, you know why I have nothing to say, because I'm just the fucking drummer. And, you know, George was the quiet. So it followed all the cliches, but I still think for all of that, because it narrowed in on that one brief time, that's what made it work.
Right. So that's like, there's a very, very popular musical that's been going on in Chicago for a while called Million Dollar Quartet. That's about like the one night that Jerry Lee Lewis and Johnny Cash and Elvis and Carl, you know, that they all got, Carl Perkins, like all got together.
Yeah.
And band. And so it's like, it's just all this thing about like that one night. That's very interesting.
I've heard of that one. I'm wondering if they, like they staged it here or not. It sounds familiar. All right. Look, at this point, we haven't even said what it is that we're going to be covering on episode one of See Here. Oh boy, you're in for a treat, folks. And it was Tim's choice for episode one. So, Tim, you announce what we're going to be talking about.
We're going to be, tonight we're going to be talking about a sweet little, delicate little, puffy little, beautiful film. It's a documentary by Todd Phillips about a man who, was very special. And he was very unique. A man who goes by the name G.G. Allin. And the documentary we're going to be covering tonight is Hated. G.G. Allin and the Motor Junkies.
Grab onto your bowels! You're about to meet your god! You slime bags don't deserve what you're going to get during the next 40 minutes or so! So get down on your knees! Now,
can I say about G.G. Allen? If you can imagine a combination of pure primordial id and a cracked up gorilla at the Brooklyn Zoo throwing feces at the glass barrier with a little bit of music thrown in there just to make it interesting. Let me explain a little bit about the history for me with G.G. Allen. Was back in the 80s, back in the days of the fanzines, before the internet really, there used to be, and I think it's still around, there was kind of like what we consider to be the punk Bible, and it was a zine called Maximum Rock and Roll, and it was based out of California. And anyway, I used to have to go to another city to actually pick up an issue of Maximum Rock and Roll. I'd have to go to Hamilton, the city over, on the bus, just to grab all my zines at the decent record store to bring them back to my little podunk hometown, yeah? So, I remember sitting in high school reading, you know, at lunchtime, sitting in the corridor and reading Maximum Rock and Roll, like, ferociously. And I'm reading this interview with this guy, G.G. Allen. And he was larger than life. It was just the most ridiculous, like, what he was talking about was just, you know, like, I mean, the most kind of, you know, nasty ass, beyond, like, just beyond anything you could imagine, you know. And I don't really want to be offensive to anyone, but, I mean, you know, just all orifices were up for grabs. And he was just bound to bet that he was either going to fight you, fuck you, or just basically turn you into a beaver skin coat, you know? Like, this guy was just insane. And me being a young, impressionable youth, I thought, oh, man, this guy's not for real. He really doesn't do this stuff. He really doesn't smear shit all over his body, and he really doesn't eat dog food and live in gutters, and, you know, he really doesn't, you know, he really isn't a sewer-sucking scumbag like he, you know, professes to be. So I wrote him a letter, and he wrote me back. And I found out very quickly that G.G. Allen was everything that he said he was, and more. So the other thing that I find interesting about G.G. too was that for all the reputation that this guy had as being a total scumbag and just lower than a snake's ass, his music, the early bands, like, this guy had been in more bands than anyone. I mean, like, you know, his discography is incredible. Like, for example, you know, he was with one of his main bands, you know, back in the day was the Jabbers, one of the bands he started out with. And some of this music that he played with him was fantastic. Just total pop punk. Really catchy. Really just amazing, like, you know, New York Dolls type of stuff. And you wouldn't kind of attribute that kind of music or that sound to a guy who was so scummy. But then eventually, he started to devolve. And as his career grew, he just became more and more rancid. He became more and more, you know, unhinged. He became more and more just a total fucking scumbag, as if he wasn't to begin with. I mean, just when you think it couldn't get any worse, it did. Right. And then he put together the Murder Junkies with his brother Merle. And this guy had been, you know, G.G. had been in and out of every fucking jail in the United States. He'd been, like, you know, every place that he'd either had his head kicked in or he'd kicked somebody's head in. Or, I mean, he was just basically walking refuse, you know. But with his band, the Murder Junkies, they went on the road. And this guy, Todd Phillips, I should say, that wound up doing the documentary, he did this for his final, I think it was his final project in NYU for the film school there. And he would go on to, he would go on to shoot, you know, The Hangover 1, 2, and 3, and other films like Party Crowd, Wedding Crashers, and I forget what else he's done. But he kind of, what had happened was that G.G. had wound up, was in prison in Adrian, Michigan for a sexual assault on a woman. And he alleged that it was consensual. And because he didn't give her money for it, she got mad and said it was rape. So there was kind of a he said, she said to the whole thing. But needless to say, he wound up doing time behind bars. He gets out. And then Todd Phillips thinks this guy is the perfect, you know, subject matter of a documentary. And this is going to be incredible. So he gets a hold of Gigi through his brother Merle and says, hey, man, you know, I want to shoot this fucking documentary about you. What do you think? And he says, all right, well, I'm going to blow off my parole. Send me a bus ticket. So Todd sends him a bus ticket, and Gigi gets on the bus, and lo and behold, he's in New York, and it begins. And that's that.
You know, can you imagine if Todd Phillips had applied more of the Gigi Allen sensibility to, let's say, Wedding Crashers? You know? Or The Hangover? Like, you know, there should have, if imagine if he had gone a little more Gigi Allen wild in movies like that.
Right. He's
never going to make it in Hollywood with that sort of sensibility.
Right. You know, so it's almost like a level. It's like, you know, you got crazy, you got fucking crazy, and then you got Gigi Allen.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? You could just see a Hollywood studio exec, and he's just like, this movie we're going to make, it's just going to be totally fucking Gigi Allen. And everyone's like, oh, shit. It's like, yeah, and plenty of it. You know, it's like, yeah, yeah.
So story of his life, who plays Gigi Allen? If someone gets paid off and they say, right, we will put out a Hollywood movie. Well, Disney say we're going to make the movie Gigi Allen's line.
One guy could play Gigi Allen, and I know who could. Daniel Day-Lewis. He'd take the challenge. He'd take the challenge, I think. To anybody who doesn't know Gigi Allen, I mean, like, this guy now has become legend. I mean, they've made toys, t-shirts, people have had his image tattooed on their bodies. You know, he was the ultimate in degradation. I mean, you know, musicians that go as low as you could go, he went there.
I have a question. How come the Gigi Allen mustache never really caught on? And Merle
actually,
has,
you know,
had a very bushy Hitler mustache going.
Oh, really? I thought it was his tribute to Charlie Chaplin.
That's what I thought.
Surely punk rockers wouldn't do something as tasteless as that.
Right.
But Gigi had it where it's like shaved in the middle and then the mustache looked like a Fu Manchu on the sides. So I'm just curious why more people haven't adopted that look as well.
Right. Well, you know what? I thought he had a total John Waters going on.
No, it wasn't like
it was a variation of no, but it was a variation of the John Waters, you know. But anyways, you know, let's get into
John
the film.
Waters can never do anything tasteless with poop.
Well, we haven't gotten to that yet. Should we sort of like run a list of some of the beautiful things that we see in this film? Within the first 2 minutes, we see a naked Gigi bashing his head with a microphone. We see a naked Gigi beating up the audience. We see him sticking a hot dog up someone's ass, then eating it. Later on in the film, we see him sticking a banana up his own crotch. We see a woman peeing into his mouth as a birthday present. And we see him taking a shit on stage, rolling around in it, and then throwing it at the audience.
Oh no, you missed the highlight when
Girl's
kissing
into
his mouth and he pukes it.
Oh, I forgot. Yes, that's true. Yes.
Laying on his back, he pukes it up out of his face.
Yes, he did. Yes.
Right. And then he eats it. And the amazing thing is that after he pukes all over his face, he goes in for another swallow of piss.
I'm dry.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, there's one thing I can say, though, from the beginning. Michael Board, who was an old famous New York punk guy who had a band called Artless. Michael Board is the guy in the beginning who introduces the concert, where he's like, all right, you slime bags, you don't deserve this for the next 45 minutes. Bow down to your god, you know? And then when Gigi comes out, I have to say that him naked, you know, he basically has a penis that makes babies look well hung. No, but I mean, you know, this guy wound up with something akin to a pig's tail, you know? And it's just like a mangina, you know? It's unbelievable. I mean, it's just you see this guy and you expect this naked virile dude and you're looking going, oh my God, you know, is that a botched sex change or something? Like, holy shit.
Does he have an angry inch?
Oh.
Right. He does. And maybe it is Hedwig. Oh, GG and yeah. Angry inch. Good go, Wendy. That's it, man. Like, yeah, definitely.
So basically this film, it projects more like a point in time in his life. And, right. You know, as you've already gone and indicated, this was a student film, so it was never meant to be a comprehensive story of his life. And, you know, I think there's, you know, maybe a little bit of a token thing as to what made Gigi what he was like, but not really in any depth. I was wondering, you know, at first, is this film going to be sympathetic? Is it just going to be a fanboy sort of film? And it wasn't. But it was pretty much, here he is. You make up your own mind. And I guess I like that approach.
Right.
There were a couple of moments though that I thought were, you know, a little bit of clever editing. There's that bit in the film where they're interviewing four, I think they're his high school buddies. And, you know, these are the, you know, the four guys who are living in suburbia, you know, from his old town. And, you know, they're all, you know, probably the highlight of their weekend is, you know, the, you know, drink a whole lot of beers and to, you know, smoke a little bit of pot when the wife's not looking, and they're sort of making fun of him. It's, oh yeah, you remember he used to do what he used to do. And then there's that bit later on where Gigi says, you know, well, I just wanted to get out of that town, and I didn't want to live one of those lives of born, go to school, right, live, pay your mortgage, pay your taxes, have kids and die.
It's been said that beauty is in the eye of the beholder, and nowhere is that more true than in my studio today. Let's meet these artists now, and we'll also meet those who feel their work is nothing but smut. This is Gigi Allen. Gigi is a rock and roller who makes the most wild punk groups pale in comparison. I don't know if you'll recall this, but he made the news recently, Gigi did, when it was revealed that he relieved himself on stage. Live. Why, Gigi, did you feel a need to defecate in front of a live audience?
Well, my body is the rock and roll temple, and my flesh, blood, and body fluids are a communion to the people, whether they like it or not. I mean, I'm not out to please anybody. My rock and roll is more not to entertain, but to annihilate. I'm trying to bring danger back into rock and roll, and there are no limits and no laws. And I'll break down every barrier put in front of me till the day I die.
There's another bit that's hilarious, but a lack of editing, where you've got Brian Hunter, Unk. And when Unk's, you know, being interviewed. Yeah, when Unk's being interviewed, when he's talking about setting up a girl to pee in Gigi's mouth on his birthday. And when he says her name, he goes, oh, shit. I just said her name. It's like, all right, we're gonna cut that, right? Yeah, yeah, cut. And they keep it all in. Like, that's hilarious, right? Like,
and the other thing that's hilarious is, like, her name is Jennifer, which could be anybody. It's like, oh, Jennifer is right, a very unique, yeah, name. Yeah. He didn't give her last, right, name.
And then, of course, they, right, have the footage in the film anyway. So, Jennifer, if you're out there with, you know, two grown up children. Sorry, we had to, right, say your name on this podcast, which is going to be listened to by the millions.
You know, something that really intrigued me about the movie was he would give these speeches about how he has the ultimate freedom and he fucks who he wants and he does what he wants and he shits where he wants and blah, blah, blah. But meanwhile, he was constantly being imprisoned, which is the absolute lack of freedom, you know? Like, was Gigi Allen really free, is my question.
Well, look, that's a great, right, question. I found myself wondering, and I don't know whether anyone else will want to make this comparison, but my knowledge of Andy Kaufman started, I guess, with, you know, watching Man on the Moon and then, you know, reading the book about him. But, you know, it seemed like, you know, at least the point that the film was trying to make was that everything he did was one great big psychological experiment on his audience. And I sort of had to wonder whether that was what G.G. Allen's aim was. You know, it's like, I'm going to do this just to see what I can do with this, or let's just see how far they go. No, no, it's not, I don't, I'm only drinking this piss just because it's for the amusement of my audience, while I'm rolling around in feces. But, you know, really what I'd love to do but when the camera's off is, you know, have a nice cup of tea and a scone and you know, talk about Jean-Paul Sartre.
Well, here's an interesting thing, is that, you know, it kind of gets into, and I mean, I'm not trying to get all fancy schmancy and get into some bumwifery intellectualism, but sociology, there was a guy named Irving Goffman, and Goffman had this theory called dramaturgy, where he kind of said, life is but a stage, like Shakespeare quoted, there's a front stage and a backstage, and you have the social self, and then you have the private self. And the social self is the person who kind of laughs at a dinner party, and the private self is the guy who sits at home after the dinner party and says, those people weren't fucking funny at all, right?
Right.
And the thing is, for all of us, we have our private selves and we have our social selves. But with a guy like G.G. Allen, he was expected to be on 24 hours a day. Like, everyone, he was so legendary for being so volatile that everyone just assumed that that guy was just, like 24 hours a day. And anybody with a brain in their head knows you can't live like that 24 hours a day. Well, you can't live long. And, you know, I mean, I knew people, a good friend of mine that passed away, Joe Collin. Joe did the definitive, you know, interview and bio on Gigi. And Joe really got to sit down with Gigi and talk with him. And Joe said, you know, like, when he wasn't playing music, when he was a laid-back, quiet guy, he kept to himself, and he was like a dog. If the dog knew you, the dog trusted you, you were fine. And if you bothered the dog and you annoyed the dog, or the dog felt like, you know, you were kind of strange, he might bite you. And that's just the way he was. But, I mean, he wasn't so... No, I mean, and here's the thing, too, that I think might be... The key of, I don't want to go so, too far ahead, but I think it might be the key of the whole documentary, is that what happens when you create a persona that is so strong, and then all of a sudden you become a victim of your persona?
Right.
You become almost trapped in a prison of your own persona, right? Where, you know, you have to, you're expected to kind of continue to live out this kind of, you know, degradation or whatever. I mean, like for example, like Unk in the film, he says, oh, you know, I can live vicariously through Gigi. He does all the shit I want to do, but I wouldn't fucking do that, but he does it for me, right?
Yep.
So he becomes like a
persona. He was trapped in a prison of a prison most of the time, you know?
Well, there you go. But he's got, no, he's got a metaphorical prison and the literal prison.
Yeah.
Right, but I'm saying, Wendy, that, you know, it's kind of like, you know, he becomes a whipping boy of these people in a way, right? And then later on, it made him even...
Yeah.
And even later on, he gets even angrier. He got more pissed off because actually what happened later on in his career is, you know, he almost becomes a parody of himself where he's like, you people want me to throw shit. You people want me to eat shit. You people want me to do this. But you know what? I won't fucking do it because it'll give you satisfaction. Fuck you, right? So he actually started stopping doing stuff because he knew it would piss people off.
Right, like in that scene where everybody expected him to kill himself eventually, and that one girl confronting him, like, you're never going to kill yourself, you know? Everybody expected him to kill himself on stage because he kept saying he was going to do it and he kept putting it off, you know?
Why don't I what? Do what? Kill myself sooner? Because it would have pleased you too much, you fucking cunt. Come up here. Why don't you come up right up here to the mic and tell me that? Come on. Come on.
You want me to?
Yeah. Why didn't I kill myself sooner? Why didn't you kill yourself sooner? I killed myself sooner! Do you want me to kill myself sooner? Well, you're gonna have to wait. Because I ain't gonna kill myself on anybody's benefit.
By the end of the film, or maybe even, you know, halfway through the film, I was sort of convinced that this guy is not so much just rallying against society, rallying against what he sees as unjust, but he was just a narcissist. And this, please, you know, give me attention, pay me attention, look at me, look at me, and yeah, I'm gonna kill myself, and when he's confronted, okay, go off and do it. No, I'm not going to do it because it will give you satisfaction. No, because I've got the attention.
Well, there are people that have basically stated, like, he was, like, right before he died, spoiler alert, he was planning a European tour, and when he was going to go to Europe, he was talking about lighting himself up in London, with kerosene and torching himself. But I think his brother actually, as much as, you know, he was kind of lacking in the DNA department, Merle had enough common sense to realize, he says, he didn't want to be a part of any of it. If his brother was going to off himself, the band didn't want to be involved because they didn't want to watch him do that. It wasn't a matter of being accomplices or it wasn't a matter of them, you know, being like legally responsible. He was just kind of saying, man, he's my fucking brother. I don't want to see my brother do that to himself. Like, you know, but it wasn't just a lot of, chest beating. I think he really realized he was getting to a point where, you know, his own life was getting annoying to himself. That he was burning hard and burning bright, and I think it was getting to a point where he was just kind of like, you know, this ain't gonna last much longer. Like, you know, this can't last much longer. And, you know, even the last show he ever did in New York City right before he died, it was insane. It was just like him, you know, going off on his band, going off on everybody. Like, he was just so miserable and just so fucking, you know, like, gone. That it wasn't even funny. I mean, right. But, you know, I want to say one thing though, and I want to just make a statement right now, is that, you know, a lot of people, like back in the day, friends of mine always thought that I had this admiration for G.G. Allin, you know, and they're like, oh man, how could you fucking like that guy? And, you know, why do you fucking listen to that music? Or blah, 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 right? For me, strictly, the whole thing that I found interesting about G.G. Allin was that, you know, with the whole punk dynamic of punk rock music, is that it was nihilism. It was supposed to be any everything. It was supposed to be against the system, against any social restraints, against, you know, social governments or organizations or any of that shit. You know, and that's what punk rock was supposed to be. And I mean, you know, when the Sex Pistols came out with God Save the Queen, you know, or, I mean, you know, the Dead Kennedys killed the poor and all these, you know, these real heavy statements or whatever. And then it's like, it gets to a point where is it just, you know, rhetoric? Like, where, you know, or is it real?
All right. Well, it's interesting to me because, like you're saying, the big thing about G.G. Allin, and I dated a few guys who are really hardcore into G.G. Allin, is, he appealed to the sort of like, you know, the sort of like middle class white guy. Like, he appealed to this very, very sort of like, you know, guys who felt like they couldn't get ahead in life. Guys who felt like he had this sort of certain appeal, and he was so
lowest
well.
Common denominator.
Yeah, the lowest common denominator. And I found myself thinking while I was watching this, like, since G.G. is gone, who is the equivalent that we have of someone who is really, really despised by society but really embraced by that sort of poor white guy kind of thing? I think Insane Clown Posse are like the closest thing we have to G.G. Allin.
No, I don't. I mean, I think there's a difference. There's a big difference because, I mean, it was kind of like, you know, with G.G., with the whole punk crowd, you know, it's like everybody, he said he did these things, and then a lot of people said, yeah, you're full of shit, right? And he said, you're right, I am, and now it's on your face, ha ha, you know, like, and he really did it. I mean, like, you know, there was people that would go to his shows, and they'd say, yeah, man, I'm a punk, I'm hardcore, blah, 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 and then go to his shows, and they'd be like, ike, and they'd run away, you know? It's like, that's what he gave them. He gave it to them. Whereas, like, I think with Insane Clown Posse, you know, those two guys, you know, they're not stupid. They know how to market this shit. You know, they know how to market, you know, dissent. They know how to market, you know, like, fuck you to the system, you know. And I mean, they're making billions. Those two dudes are billionaires.
Sort of, yeah, they're appealing to that same sort of disenfranchised crowd, though, is what I feel is interesting.
So, yeah, that's the exact expression that Unk in the film went and made about G.G. Allin appealing to the disenfranchised youth of America. I don't know. I mean, I also found it, you know, a little bit strange. As someone who didn't really get into punk, I mean, now I'm sort of finding myself, you know, interested in some of the music. But, you know, Unca goes and says that he heard all these things that Gigi had done and he found them appealing, and that's punk rock. And I'm just wondering, you know, what was it about someone throwing shit into the audience and singing about, you know, fuck you, fuck you, fuck you, and running around and beating up his audience. I can't empathize. I don't understand what it is that made that appealing. You know, to hear high energy music, fine. To have a message or something to say, fine. But when someone is so incredibly angry, that includes, you know, beating up, I hate everyone. At one point, Gigi even, like, he's in his hotel room. He says, I hate you, motherfucker. I hate you, motherfucker. Fuck, I hate you. And he really, when he says he hates everyone, that is it. I'm biting the hand that feeds me.
But I mean, you know, like, the thing is too, and I mean, I'm not trying to blow smoke up this, you know, like, on, or blow this guy up, but I think, in a way, like, you look at Nihilus in the past, he was, like, just a complete nihilist, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, but, I mean, a primordial nihilist, yeah. You know, I mean, a gutter nihilist, sure. But, I mean, like, you look at the nihilists, like, you know, the whole nihilist movement, like, in terms of philosophy and stuff, where they said everything has no meaning, like, nothing is nothing, like, you know, it's like everything is doomed, like, you know, it's just that whole, like, the end is now, like, you know, and he even talks, like, about that, where he says, you know, I don't even think about tomorrow, it's just I'm thinking about right now, I'm thinking about the situation I'm in and trying not to get arrested, and I'm just trying to stay one step ahead of the law, and,
right,
you know.
At this point, I want to ask Wendy a question. Now, one person in the cast of characters, I guess as we could call them, who we haven't discussed, who we really need to discuss.
Is it the drummer?
You knew where I was going with that? Dino the drummer.
Dino, tell me something about yourself. What are you like?
What am I like? Why, I'm just peace and love in the midst of all violence. And I am free, legal, and innocent. Squid the O, Gina, Cindy, Becky, Lunar Chicks are number one. Gigi Rock, Led Zeppelin, Jimi Hendrix, Brooke.
When he came, like, to be interviewed, I thought, oh, hang on. Sorry, am I watching the outtakes from Spinal Tap? Sure.
First of all, can we talk about the drummer's belief that he has a telepathic communication with the Lunar Chicks?
Please.
Like, I want to know what the Lunar Chicks' end of that was. I want to know if they thought this guy was really creepy. That's the movie I want to see.
That might be the next one. Is Dino still with us?
Oh, yeah. He's still playing with the Murder Junkies. Yeah, yeah.
What, the Murder Junkies still going on?
Yeah, they have a different singer. Oh, yeah, they've been still going on. Oh, yeah. What? Absolutely.
See them with a different singer.
Well, you see, this is kind of a funny thing, but it's like I was saying earlier about how, you know, you're trying to make the correlation between, you know, like, the Insane Clown Posse and Gigi, where I said, you know, that these two guys, you know, they've made basically a mountain of cash off of, you know, kind of the pseudo-deviancy. Well, Merle, when Gigi died, that was the best thing that could have ever happened for Merle, because he made a mountain of cash off of selling Gigi t-shirts and Gigi CDs and Gigi memorial grave rubbings, and they have the tribute concerts and, you know, the memorial concerts, and then they kept the Murder Junkies going with different singers, and actually there was a guy, Jeff Clayton from Anti-Scene, that was singing with them for a while, and then and Anti-Scene had recorded with Gigi when, you know, back in the day. And I mean, Merle made a ton of cash after the fact, which I think is kind of ironic. You know, it's kind of funny. It's like, my brother dies, I'm really sad, but hey, you want a t-shirt? Like, you know, it's like, you know.
Yeah, it's so yeah. But right. But yeah, like, that's really interesting, because who would go see the Murder Junkies for the music? You know, that's not why people are going to those shows. My favorite thing in that interview with the drummer, aside from the weird Lunar Chicks thing, was when he was explaining why he plays naked. Now, Morris, you're a drummer as well.
Yes. And I can honestly say that sitting on a drum stool, yeah, I can understand what he's saying. Yeah, I feel chaffed when I'm wearing pants. Yeah, yeah.
Are you revealing to us that you also don't like to wear pants? Is that what you're saying?
I wear pants because I don't think that the general public would like to see what goes on down there. But
are
it
you
does,
wearing pants
it does
right change. Now?
I'm just not. Say no to crack.
His justification that wearing pants chafes him too much, I just thought that was absolutely hilarious. Because if there's anything that's comfortable, it's sitting on, like, you know, the cold leather or plastic of a drum stool, you know?
Now, this is going to sound really terrible, but the funniest bit I love about Dino in the film is that when Unk's talking about the fact that he says, oh yeah, Dino did time because he exposed himself to people in the past. And then he says, yeah, he got busted for exposing himself to a little girl. And when I talked to him about it, he just said he was teasing her.
Oh yeah, that guy was nuts.
Oh yeah. And you know, that's just it. Is, I mean, you know, it's like you get a collection of miscreants, like so many nut bars that are playing together. I mean, well, the only guy that really kind of had his head on straight was Bill Weber, who was playing guitar with the band.
Right.
And it was Bill had played with the Cramps.
Consequently, he's not the one that they interview.
Right.
I remember a few years ago, I went and read this this biography on the Beach Boys, and at one point in the book, they said that Al Jardine had been faithful to his wife, and he didn't do drugs, and he never did anything wacky like the rest of them did, so consequently they had nothing to say about him. And obviously this Bill Weber was the Al Jardine of the Murder Junkies.
Right.
Yeah,
you know,
the last
it's
time anyone compares Beach Boys to the Murder Junkies.
Right. But we also have to mention, importantly, they're one weak member.
Oh, you're talking about G.G. Allen's penis.
No, I'm talking about the legendary D.D. Ramone.
Oh, sorry. You said his one weak member, and I thought you were talking about, like, the little...
Yeah. There you go. Kazing! No, like, when Dee Dee winds up joining the band for 1 week...
That's right, I forgot.
And that doesn't last long after he finds out what they're all about, you know?
And we know how intense... it must have been to be a member of the Murder Junkies when Dee Dee Ramone says, this is too fucked up even for me.
All right.
I'm just so confused as to how he didn't die of some sort of like a parasite from eating all that shit all the time. Like how he didn't die from E. coli or something. I would have thought that would have killed him for sure.
Well, that's the funny thing. At the end of the film, they go and say that for a guy who liked to live life on the outside and didn't consider himself part of the rock mainstream, and he was always just one step ahead of the law, he died the most conventional rock star way by just through...
No, he started a heroin overdose.
Heroin overdose, yeah. That was right. Yeah.
No, what's really funny about it is
has there been any other rock star who's died from poo poisoning?
I don't know. I wish there were. I think that'd be a greater myth than, like, the Mama Cass ham sandwich, you know?
Oh, absolutely.
Right. No, I was going to say that the kind of funny thing about Gigi's death was, you know, I mean, it's insane. If you see the footage from the last show that he did, he goes out on the street full on in the middle of the day, buck naked, stops a public bus, and he's standing there, and he's basically bashing his head off the windshield of the public bus and, like, punching this bus. And then the police are trying to show up, and they're looking for them. And then they cover him up in a jacket and then a skirt. Then they're trying to get into a taxi, and they wouldn't let him into a taxi because he's all covered in blood and shit. And then finally they get him off, and they take him to this guy Johnny Puke's house where he winds up snorting a bag of heroin. They eventually does him in. But the irony, it's kind of funny, was that when he was passed out, all the people at the house were getting Polaroid snapshots with their arm around Gigi, and they had no idea he was dead.
Oh!
So they're all sitting there getting pictures with him, and he's conked out, you know, wearing a little skirt, you know, like a tartan skirt and a leather jacket, and that's it. And he's dead. He was gone.
I don't think it would have stopped the Polaroids if they knew, though.
Right. There've been more.
I was going to say one thing that we haven't actually discussed is the music. I mean, look, yeah, Tim, because you know you and Eric did that Love That Album episode, which we called The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Punk, and you know you went through a whole history of punk, and you know, said punk is not one thing, punk is many things. So
sure.
from your perspective, was, you know, regardless of, I can't sort of comment because, you know, musically, it's not my thing. I found the whole story fascinating and I was really glad that you got us to cover this. But I can't speak from my perspective, you know, because I'm inexperienced about the music. As a punk fan, is the music good? I mean, is it considered good by, you know, punk standards, or is it just, or was it more about the cult of personality?
Well, like I said, you know, like his as his character evolved, the music devolved too. I mean, in the beginning, like Gigi, you know, Gigi and the Jabbers and the early stuff that he did, it was more pop punk.
Yep.
It was more like the Ramones and like more like, you know, the Dead Boys and that kind of thing, right? And it was really catchy stuff. I mean, there was a lot of great early Gigi pop punk that is fantastic, and I still stand by that. And everyone's like, how could you listen to Gigi Allin? I'm like, well, you obviously haven't listened to his early stuff. I mean, there was talent there, and he wrote these songs, he wrote the lyrics, and it wasn't early stuff, like, wasn't all the, you know, fuck you, fuck you, fuck you. It was like, he has a song, Don't Talk to Me, and it's
right.
Like, you know,
I heard that today.
On the phone. Yeah, I'm sitting here on the phone, and then, you know, Don't Talk to Me, Don't Talk to Me. It's a catchy song. But what I'm saying is, as his character evolved, the music evolved or devolved, depending on who you talk to, and it became more virile, it became more deviant, more about fuck society, fuck the law, fuck everyone, you know, expose yourself to kids, you know, eat my fuck, you know, suck my ass, it smells, like, oh, like, it just spiraled out of control, and by the last album that he did, Brutality and Bloodshed for All, he sounded more like the Cookie Monster, and he's just like, you know, like, rape everyone, no, you know, it's like, you know, and it was just like, oh man, like, you know, when you really paid attention to what the guy was doing, and you seen where he came from as to where he wound up, you know, some people liked it in the end, but then there was a lot of people that were just like, dude, man, like, you know, you were really talented. And this is a funny thing, is that you just can't write this guy off as a Kardashian, you know, like, you just can't write him off as a fucking, like, you know, just a, you know, a media darling, you know, or infamy, because he really did have talent, and he really did, he was a drummer as well. Which is kind of funny, a lot of people don't know. But he really did have inherent talent, and he really had the ability to write some really great songs. I mean, in the beginning, you know. But what happened was that became eclipsed by his notoriety. It became, you know, all of it became. And what's even funnier is that, you know, what I was saying about, you know, him not doing what everyone wanted him to do to piss them off, he had actually talked about, in the end, becoming a country and western singer, strictly country and western, because he knew all the punks hated country. So he says, well, I love country. That's what I want to do, and I'll do it just to fucking piss them off.
Material, or did he do more than one album?
Well, he's done multiple recordings of country. Like, he recorded a lot of country songs when he was in prison, because, like, I mean, he, you know, and this was the thing too that's really kind of funny about this guy, as much as, you know, we've talked about the one end, how he was an animal and how he was unhinged and how he did all this, you know, repellent shit, he was also on the ball in terms of marketing himself. Everywhere he went, he had cassettes. Every town that he went to, he'd find a little studio and he'd come up with $200 to record a 45 or to record a 7-inch or whatever, and to put out new music. And the thing is, it's really interesting, is that he could go from town to town and find guys that would want to play with him. And they'd just sit down and record. And all of a sudden, he's got a new band for 2 days. They'd record something, and then he'd be gone. And then he'd wind up finding somebody to press his stuff. And that, I mean, like, if you really look at G.G. Allin, like, in terms of his discography, you know, this is the thing that's kind of an anomaly, where you think, for a guy who was living so wild and so, you know, hard, you wouldn't expect that he was able to put out so much music, but he did. He put out a hell of a lot of music. Oh, there's a ton of stuff, you know? And this is the thing, where, you know, it kind of like, this is going back to what I was saying earlier, where it's kind of like, look, if this guy was living this life 24/7, there's no way he'd be able to, you know, like, it's like being a complete psychotic. You know, if you're mentally ill, you can't say, well, okay, well, I'll be mentally ill from 9 a.m. to, like, 5 p.m., and then I'll just be a normal guy for the rest of the day, right? Like, you know, if you're fucked, right? But with him, he actually found the time, and he found the means to record and to go in and do all these things, you know? So it kind of, you know, a lot of people might say, well, then it was just an act, you know, like him playing live and him doing what he did was all just a kind of a shtick, you know. But it really wasn't a shtick. But what it was just one facet of this guy's personality. You know, it's like, you know, like I said, it's like a dog. If you look at a dog, you know, we look at dogs as being cute, but at the same time, they can bite you, right? And at the same time, they shit. At the same time, they eat their shit. And at the same time, they roll around in filth. And at the same time, we love them.
And that's partly the problem, I guess, with the documentary. So we've spoken a lot about Allin and, you know, Dino and, you know, and the cast of thousands in the film. But I guess, as in any documentary or in any film, the director has to take the tack of, right, this is the angle I want to present. This is not a comprehensive tale of Gigi's life. We can't present to you the sensitive side or the quiet side.
You see, that's the problem I have with this film, though. The one real gripe that I have is that if they were able to kind of go back and show, because he was a father, he had actually, you know, he has a daughter, he was married, he was a regular Joe, and he got into the whole kind of glam scene, actually, like around the early 80s, you know, like almost like Motley Crue and like the LA scene. Like he was really into kind of like Cooper and all that type of thing. And then he just wound up going really deviant, right? But I'm just saying, if the film had gone and shown kind of the transition, then it would have been more meaningful, because everyone would have went, well, wow, this guy has some kind of, you know, like really poppy music or whatever. Like, what the hell happened? Like, what triggered him, you know? But instead, the film just kind of shows the blah, like, you know, but they really don't show anything else.
Well look, there is the one moment that makes you think that maybe there was more, because you see him, that little bit of footage where he's in a room by himself strumming on the guitar and playing Warren Zevon's Carmelita, and that really took me by surprise, and I thought, wow, there's, you know, he does have another, you know, musical side to him. I mean, earlier on today, I went, you know, it's a bit of a YouTube rabbit hole, and came across the song Outskirts of Life, and even though lyrically it was still, you know, within, I guess, the same sort of subject matter that he did within his more hardcore punk style of thing, you know, I hate everyone, everyone hates me,
yeah,
you all, but it was done with a whole lot more melodicism. So,
right.
As you say, you know, it, really, the film, I don't know, do you think the film paints him as a bit two-dimensional?
Yeah, I mean, I think it does in a way, because, you know, it's like, you know, it's, there's, they poke holes in it. I mean, like, for example, they go back to his hometown, and they have the one teacher who talks about him as a kid, and he's saying, you know, well, he never caused anybody any trouble in class, and, you know, like he just was a regular guy, and then you have his friends who said, well, he wore women's clothing to school, and he got the shit kicked out of him a lot, and then you wind up, you know, everyone's saying, well, where does this all stem from, and then they talk about his father, and then, you know, with Merle talking about his father and how insane his father was, how he dug four graves in his basement of his house, and they lived in a log cabin, and there was no electricity and no water.
I was wondering if that was true. I was wondering about the validity of that story, or if that was more creating.
No. There's a lot of truth to that, because you see, the thing was that his father was the one who actually labeled him Jesus Christ Allen when he was born. His father named him Jesus Christ, and then his mother divorced his father after a number of years and separated and took the boys, and she was the one who gave him the name Kevin Michael Allen. And then, you know, from there, you know, Gigi was, actually the funny thing about Gigi was that Merle had always said that because he'd been called Jesus, Merle as a little kid couldn't say Jesus, and he just kept saying Gigi, Gigi. So that's where the tag Gigi came from, right?
Okay.
But I've always wondered whether or not it came from Iggy.
You know, I've wanted to make mention of this. I'd forgotten, but you and I, Tim, we've previously been discussing
that
Iggy.
Makes me wonder, you know.
And also, yeah, I did a podcast recently with Eric Peterson talking about Iggy Pop, and you know, I think we made the point about how, you know, comparing say Iggy to Alice Cooper. You know, Alice was all about theatrical danger, but Iggy seemed to be a whole lot more dangerous. But you know, Gigi was a whole lot more dangerous yet again.
Right, and it makes you wonder whether or not it's like, you know, this guy. And I mean, this is just it, right? It's just like, you wonder whether or not he actually had the intellect to kind of consider the fact that, you know, there has to be an evolution. There has to be a de-evolution evolution, if you know what I'm saying. It's like, you know, everybody thought Alice was bad, but then Iggy came out, and then, you know, he's bad. Well, then, well, what's after Iggy? You know, like, there's got to be something else, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So it makes me wonder whether or not he even pondered that, you know, whether or not he thought how far, you know, like, these guys took it that far, and, you know, it's almost like Jack Nicholson in Batman, you know, as a Joker. He's like, get a load of me, you know. Like,
yeah.
He comes out and it's just like, holy shit, you know, like, and that's just it. And what's really sad to me is it's like, you know, the way we are so kind of absorbed as a society with media figures and these kind of figures that come out of nowhere and how people gain notoriety, right, you know, and it's just like, you know, how do you get people to take notice anymore aside from shitting on the floor and rolling around in it and eating it and throwing it at people? I mean, you know, like a fucking gorilla, you know? It's like,
isn't that why that's popular?
Yeah, exactly. But like I said, you know, if it was just that, then you could dismiss him as a just complete reprobate and a complete, you know, moronic, you know, sad sack case. But when you look at the music that he made in the past and some of his acoustic stuff, I mean, you know, and again, you know, I have to make a statement that, you know, I'm not behind any of, you know, the intent or the music that he, the lyrical stuff, because, I mean, he was, you know, pro-rape, pro-hate, anti-black, anti-everybody, like, you know, it was just anybody that, you know, it's like, well, who can I piss off? Well, who do you have? You know, like that's it. You know, he was against everybody, you know, and I think, you know, he was in a situation, I think, where it's like, you know, how could he reach as many people as possible and piss as many people off as he possibly could? Well, I have to write an anti-Jewish song today, so then I have Jewish people that hate me, and then I got to write an anti-black song, so then black people hate me, and then I got to write an anti-rich song, so rich people hate me. Like, you know, like, it just seemed like a lot of the music he wrote was just, you know, to cover all bases, like, to have all people basically despise the guy.
he achieved that for I guess a good chunk of society, and yet, you know, the so-called disenfranchised seem to say, yeah, we hate them too, we hate them too. Yeah, you hate us, yeah, we hate us too.
I want to ask that, what did you guys take away from this film? I mean, you know, I've seen, like, Film Threat Video. I should explain that Film Threat was a magazine that was out in the 90s. And
oh, yeah,
Film Threat was kind of like an underground kind of indie film magazine. And Film Threat had a video division where they would kind of, you know, put out these films independently. Like, for example, Necromantic 1 and 2. And there was a lot, the Red video, there was with Lawrence Tierney. There was a bunch of things that Film Threat put out. But then they were the ones that initially put out Hated, this documentary. It was through the magazine. Because nobody in their right mind, there was no studios or anybody that would touch this thing with a 10-foot pole, right? But Film Threat put it out. That was the first time I got to see it, because my buddy Joe was a comic book artist, and he was doing panels for Film Threat, you know, doing pages, and part of the payment that they sent him was they sent him some promo videos, and they sent him G.G. Allen's Hated. So he watched it once, and then he was just like, this is yours, this is all you, man, like, no. And then, you know, I watched it and I was blown away. But I mean, I've seen this thing like over, you know, 50, 60 times, the video. But, you know, just because it's one of those things where you love springing it on people. And you're like, look, I know this isn't you. I know this music isn't you, but you got to see this. Tell me what you think. You know, and you can just spring it on people. And all you have to do is just sit back and look at their face. Watch their eyeballs get wide.
Wendy?
Hello?
Had you seen this before?
Yeah, I'd seen it. I'd seen it years ago. Like I said, I've dated guys who also gave me the same arguments about how I should like G.G. Allen, because at one point he was melodic, you know? So I mean, yeah, I've seen this before, and I've heard, you know, the arguments pro and con for G.G. before. And yeah, I mean, I think he's an interesting figure, you know? I mean, I feel like if you didn't have someone like him, you'd have to make it up, you know?
Right. I remember a few weeks ago, I watched this twice in preparation for the show. I'd never seen him, I'd never listened to anything. I think I'd been vaguely aware of his story or who he was, and I'd never had the nerve to actually watch the film. But, you know, I'm glad that this podcast forced me to actually do so. But it was interesting, I think, you know, a few weeks ago after I'd watched it for the first time, I put a post on the Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, or the, you know, the GG TMC.
The GG Allen
TMC.
The GG Allen TMC Facebook page. And it was fascinating. I think there was a lot of responses to it. It must have been about 40, 50 responses. And he clearly divided people up. There were some who were still convinced of either his brilliance or his importance, and a whole bunch of other people said, nope, he's just a fucking scumbag. It's the emperor's new clothes if you think he's great.
Right.
And completely divisive. And I found that fascinating. And in the end, it doesn't matter what I personally think about the music, or, you know, because quite clearly this is really, it's not my bag. Although, you know, some of the country tunes that I've been like listening to on YouTube, I thought, you know, were just wonderful. But it was just a fascinating story, and I think that's, you know, going to be the beautiful thing ongoing with the podcast, and whether we watch the documentaries or the narratives, it's the story, you know. I don't want to say the music's incidental, because this is a music related podcast, you know, that might be a separate discussion.
But
I guess coming out of this, and we discussed this a few minutes ago, was that, you know, maybe, you know, because of what you've gone and said, Tim, the film couldn't quite give us a well-rounded description of what he was like. You know, you've gone, you know, made the analogy, you know, a dog will bite you, or a dog might lie faithful by your side. Yeah, so in the end, I just don't think it really matters terribly much about whether the music was important to us as film viewers, but it was still a great tale, even if it was only one perspective of the guy. But I'm still interested enough to go out and, you know, search out whatever other information that there could be about him.
There's one thing that a lot of people may not realize is that Gigi actually was planning on starting, when he finished the whole punk rock thing, he was planning on starting a prog band. And he wanted to do prog versions of his music. He was going to call it the Gigi Allen Parsons Project. No, seriously,
was this going to be his major tune? Was going to be Brown Eye in the Sky?
No,
that's right.
Exactly. Eye scum- all week, folks. Try the veal.
Eye scumbag. Yeah, exactly. No, like I think this film is, like I said, you know, earlier when we were talking in the beginning of this recording about how great documentaries actually will draw you in and give you perspective about artists that you might not even really like or artists that you might not even really understand. But then after you watch the documentaries, you kind of get a different insight or something completely, you know, like it compels you to continue to watch it. And I mean, with this one, you might say that it's the equivalent of a car crash, you know, drive by in a car crash that you can't take your eyes off, even though you wish you could. But, I think that there's something to be said here, like that this is really one of the better music documentaries that I've seen. And I mean, it's one of the more legendary music documentaries, because when this came out, I'm not trying to, you know, make the stretch and say it's at the same level, but, this is almost like the Mercedes Brothers, Gimme Shelter, where, you know, like with Gimme Shelter, when all that shit was happening live and how, you know, people were dealing with a situation that was out of control and, you know, and somebody was getting killed and there was music still being played and, you know, the Stones were just kind of like, what the hell's going on? It was just something happening in the midst of a concert that was, you know, most people just weren't really ready to accept or ready to, you know, get a grip on.
Right.
So I think in that aspect, I think, you know, it has similarities to Gimme Shelter in that way that, you know, it's kind of like you're a fly on the wall to something that's happening and, you know, a lot of people aren't liking it, but a lot of people are there and it's just, they're still grooving. And it's kind of that, you know, that really, the aura of really bad shit going on, you know, but the last thing I want to say is that this film, though, as much as I say that, you know, it's necessary viewing, you should be aware that this is definitely not for the more sensitive, and this is definitely not for your younger viewers. This film is
maybe Charles Manson's kids.
Yeah, right. Charlie's family definitely would be into this one, but
I should also add, if you want to find this film, it is on YouTube in its entirety.
Right, but know your friends before you show them this, or you might lose them.
All right, well, with that, I think we can call a close to episode one of the See Here podcast. And I'd like to thank everyone who took a chance and downloaded this. Hope you like it. I think here on in, you know, we might not be covering material quite as full-on as hated. But you never know. We might come back to that sort of material from time to time. So, Wendy, it's your choice of film next month. You chose something that also has a bit of a punk-related theme.
Yeah, I chose Ladies and Gentlemen, The Fabulous Stains, because I saw it, like, on Night Flight or on USA. I saw it, like, on one of those, like, years and years ago. It's much like your Human Highway story. Like, I remember seeing, like, half of it on TV late one night and being really blown away by it. So I just wanted an excuse to rewatch it and form my own opinion, you know, at this stage of my life.
I haven't seen that one yet, so look forward to having a bit of a discussion for that on next month's See Here podcast. Thank you very much for listening. And I should also, I just want to make one final quick announcement. The opening theme of our show was composed by my son, Max. A little bit of nepotism there, but, you know, hell.
You rock!
Max rocks. And I begged him. I said, please, please, please compose a theme for the show. And he said, well, all right, you know.
Max, so shy, so demure.
Yeah, that's him.
I said, don't forget to pay him them royalties.
Yeah,
right. give him a little extra, like 5 cents extra in his allowance every week. Yeah.
Right. The irony is I won't let him listen to the podcast, at least not episode one of the podcast that his music has been a part of. Maybe episode two will be a little bit.
You're not going to let him see Gigi?
No. I am sort of diversifying what he can see now. He's getting older, but not that one yet. No, I don't think so. So next month, ladies and gentlemen, the Fabulous Stains, and I'll post on the usual places, because at this point in time as we're recording, I don't know where I'm going to, who I'm going to be putting this podcast with. I haven't gone and created the Facebook page. I haven't gone and created an email. But by the time you have downloaded this, you'll be aware of all this sort of thing, because I'll be relying on some of our friends to help publicize at least the first episode. So you'll be aware of all those details after you've downloaded this one anyway. But from next episode on, we'll give you all those details on a monthly basis. So hope you've enjoyed it. And when you're aware of what the email address is, please send us feedback. We thrive on that. And tell your friends that this music film discussion podcast exists. And if you know us from our other ventures, please support those. Wendy, quickly tell us about your other ventures.
Oh, I am on the Double Page Spread podcast, where you can hear me interview comic creators and talk about comic books. Recently, I talked about The Fifth Beatle, which was a great graphic novel about the life of Brian Epstein.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really good. I think you'd really, really enjoy that a lot.
I'll be getting that one for sure.
Yes, and also, I am a co-host of the Trashy Trios, where we talk about very, very sleazy, filthy movies.
Completely unlike the movie that we discussed tonight. Thank you very much to Wendy and Tim for agreeing to this venture. I'm really, really excited and looking forward to doing many more
podcasts. Thank you, man.
Yay, thanks.
All right, and cheers to all you folks out there. We'll see you next month on the See Here podcast. Cheers.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.